Translation. With this consideration, Advaita Acharya Prabhu, promising to cause Lord Krishna to descend, began to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna with tulsi leaves and water of the Ganges. Purport. Tulsi leaves and Ganges water, with, if possible, a little pulp of sandalwood, is sufficient paraphernalia to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam Yomi Bhaktya Priyachati Tadahang Bhakti Upahritam Ashnami Prayatatmanaha. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I will accept it. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, text 26. Following this principle, Advaita Prabhu pleased the Supreme Personality of Godhead with tulsi leaves and water of the Ganges. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Hare Krishna, everyone. Hare Krishna. By the grace of Nanda, I am here again. Where is Nanda? Thank you, Nanda. Without Nanda, without Nanda's loud cries, I would not be here. Advaita Acharya lived, we are discussing the, well, you could say, one of the key verses of Chaitanya Charitamrita, because it is with this verse we discover how Krishna comes into this world in his most merciful manifestation. We have many appearances of the Lord within this world. Krishna says, Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata bhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam shajamiyaham. Paratranaya sarunam. I lift them up. I lift them up. And the duskritinas I'll do away with. So Krishna comes many times, and you can take your pick. There's one purport where Prabhupada says, you can choose. You can have any avatar of the Lord in your home. We are a very liberal religion, okay? When the Christian missionaries went to India, they said, we've come to tell you about the Bible. They said, oh yes, very good, very good. Please sit, tell us. He said, yes, we've come all the way from England to tell you about religion. And the Hindus said, oh, very good, thank you, we love to talk about religion. They said, we've come to tell you about God. He said, oh yes, please tell us more, tell us more. Well, God is all great, he's all merciful, he's all wise, he's infinite, he's eternal, he's the origin of all things and the end of all things, he's the Alpha and the Omega. And the Hindus went, oh, wow, 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 wow. It was wonderful. Huh? And then they said, now we want to tell you about the Son of God. Oh, the Son of God, wonderful, tell us more, tell us more. And now we've come to tell you about John 3:16. John 3:16, that God gave his only son, only one son. And all the Hindus said, kya? God is unlimited, almighty, all-powerful, and he only has one boy. Kya kata hai? What is the problem? So at that point they had to say, very nice, our God, same God. Son, prophet, avatar, saint, we understand. But only one. Only one. There's no good. When I was 8 years old, I remember asking my mother this question. I said, so what happens to a person when, you know, they're in a far distant place? And when I grew up in Cornwall, so a far distant place for me was sort of like London. It was way off to the north. I'd never been to London. I went once, actually. I couldn't remember it. I just remember the pigeons in Trafalgar Square, and that was it. So London was we didn't know what Russia was, because we looked at a map of Russia in our day, and all you could see was no rivers, no mountains, no towns, no cities. It was just a big empty space on the map, you see, because there was a big wall between us and Russia. No one knew what was there. So on some maps, they didn't even show Russia. It was just USSR. Nothing was there. Okay. And then I was speaking to my friend in East Germany, and he said when he was growing up, anything on the western side of the Berlin Wall, it was just an empty space on the map. They didn't tell you what was there. So we were both growing up with, this empty tract, empty track. There was just nothing there. So for us, I said, well, what happens if someone, say, like in you know, Russia, they don't learn about Jesus? Because I thought Jesus was sort of English. You know, because the pictures at Sunday school was he was white, and the children gathered around him were white, and everybody was white. And I thought, well, Jesus was a white man, obviously. I mean, obviously, Anglo-Saxon, like me. And, you know, all over the world, that was... So what happens if they don't come to Jesus? Do they go to hell? And she, my mother, she said, well, I don't know, I suppose. I suppose they might get another chance. I said, how will they get another chance? She said, well, I don't know. Why don't you ask the priest? Why don't you ask the vicar? So I never really got answers to my questions that if one... Son of God, if you don't come to know that Son of God, who's the way, the truth, and the life, then what happens? And this was, of course, the idea of Victorian missionizing all around the world. You took the message of Jesus, and you took the message of industrialization and capital all over the world. And these two things went hand in hand, and that's how we had the British Empire. Which didn't last very long, actually. If you look at the history of the civilization of the world, is a young Indian gentleman here going, no, it did not last very long. But it happened in India. It lasted long enough to do some damage. Long enough to do some damage. Long enough that India today is still not proud enough of Hinduism. Still thinks that Christianity is advanced and that Hinduism is backward. You ask many people in India, and Christianity is something sophisticated, intellectual. It's an advanced civilization, okay? And Hinduism is for backward people, primitive, stuck in superstition. Isn't it? Am I right? Yes. He's nodding. You're my barometer of Indian culture. So we have to shake off these notions because these notions are imperialistic. They're based on the days of the British Empire, that when the empire came to you with a message, obviously they were the most powerful, and therefore the most powerful people physically were following the best path. That's like saying, in my school, all the boys who are in the sixth form, all that they say is correct because they're bigger than me. This does not work, my friends. It doesn't work. Civilization doesn't work like that. Since the way we look at the world is very much governed like this. The world is round, okay? Just for those of you who were wondering, the world is round. Colonel Tim Peake told me, he's been up there, he's gone around it many times. And so we discovered in this part of the world something called a clock to work out longitude. And this clock was installed in about 80% of the ships that were going all over the world, and it stopped you banging onto the rocks and losing the lives of the sailors. And so this clock was invented in a place called Greenwich. So all the calculation of time and longitude was calculated from Greenwich, which then became 0 degrees longitude. So with 0 degrees longitude, you started counting east, and then you came to something that was way off in the east, and that was called the Far East. Where was it far from? It was far from Greenwich. And then in between Greenwich and the Far East was something called the Middle East. Well, it was the Middle East because it was halfway between the Far East and Greenwich. You couldn't make it up, could you? Well, it was made up. It was made up. So now we talk about the problems in the Middle East, or the inscrutable wisdom of the Far East. These are just man-made terms. But it's a governing principle that whatever civilization you grow up in, somehow that civilization is at the peak of human intellectual endeavor. We're at the peak. You can't get further than 2016. We kind of know everything now. Well, do you know there was another group of people who thought that they knew everything? They were called the Romans. And before them, it was the Egyptians. We know everything now. We've gone as far as we possibly can in human research. So every civilization carries with it some intrinsic collective pride that we know we're enjoying, we're proud, we have conquered, we have people who look up to us for our sophistication. And in there lies the seed of the downfall of that civilization. Historians who have studied civilizations find that it goes like this. You'll be not surprised to hear. Dharma, Artha, Karma, and then usually no moksha. That's the history of the civilizations that you study in school. Okay? They're religious people. They do religious things. They believe in God and gods and goddesses. And they believe that there should be virtues. They encode those virtues in civilized social behavior. Civilization rises as a result. The gods are pleased. The rain falls, the crops grow, the rivers flow. Everything's very nice. There's a peaceful king who's just, wise, but firm. Okay? Like Ram Raja, only the Egyptian version of Ram Raja, or the English version of Ram Raja. Okay? So we have that situation. And then, because in their power, if there comes pride, then they tend to do away with Dharma. Dharma becomes eclipsed at the point of calm or enjoyment. And so we find that the civilization becomes more and more engaged in extremes of sense gratification to the point where they completely forget virtue, morality. They breach any boundaries of good civilized human conduct. And the upshot of that is that the whole civilization becomes weak, weak, weak. And then they become very easily conquered by another civilization who comes in, who does have the power of God and virtue, and they superimpose everything on top of them. And this is just the history of the world, folks. It happens. So don't go thinking that that England is unconquerable. If there is rampant sense gratification in this country will collapse. Similarly, America. It will all collapse. And human civilization is in a process of ever-changing flux. So the principles of human civilization lie in how people deal with sense gratification, how they deal with their innate ability to just enjoy more and more and more without any restriction. There's only one way that you can really do that. You remove religion from society. You remove religion. If you remove religion from society, then there's no reason. Because if you remove religion, all you are as a human being is a biological mechanism. Okay? If that's the concept that you want to work with, you're just a biological mechanism, there's no good and bad. It's just survival of the fittest. So you remove God from the picture, you put God to one side, you say that's an outmoded idea. And then you're free. Then you're free. So there are many scientists who have now become the new priests. And they're saying, no, you don't have to worry about morality. Morality is just a way that, it's just like ants or bees. There's a way by exchange of pheromones that they behave in the hive or in the ant nest. And as human beings, there's a sort of language that it's called morality. But you don't really have to worry about that because underpinning that is just survival of the fittest. So if that's what you want, that's what you get. So we are engaged in a struggle. This Krishna consciousness movement is engaged in a struggle, actually. Because in my lifetime, just in my lifetime, religious language, religious behavior, even religious concepts, and I'm talking about religious as God consciousness as applied to human interaction, has been, we've gone from maybe half a moon to, a thin sliver of a moon. And it's very, very dangerous situation that we're in. So this is wonderful. Bhaktivedanta Manor is wonderful. It's when you go beyond into the real world. You try to engage with people. You will find that some of the ideas, spirituality, that's very good, but it's still a sort of sensuality stroke spirituality. It's spirituality to the point where I don't have to give up anything, where spirituality becomes another feeling that I can have. We find that sometimes. Prabhupada called it the half-chicken philosophy. Where the man cuts the chicken in half because the back end of the chicken is producing him eggs that he can sell at market, but the front end of the chicken is costing a lot of money. So he doesn't want to feed the chicken, but he wants the eggs. So he cuts the chicken in half and has nothing. So Prabhupada said that they do with religion. They want the good bits without the bad bits, so-called. So they cut it all in half. So where was this rampant, this type of civilization, where was it rampant? Sometimes we look back at, we look at Bengal, what we now have as West Bengal, and Bangladesh, now cut in half. but we look back at that and we think, oh, those were the glory days, the wonderful days of Krishna consciousness in India. Everybody was a devotee. No. One of the most popular things to do in Navadvip at the time of the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was to go to a dog wedding, where two dogs were getting married. There's great festivity and great, it's just, we have the, in order to cope with, we have Sharia law, and people think, oh, this is a new thing trying to impose upon us in this country, Sharia law, now everybody knows about Sharia law. Well, 500 years ago in Bengal, they really knew about Sharia law. Why was Haridas Thakur whipped until death in a marketplace? Sharia law. Because he was chanting Hare Krishna, and he was from a Muslim family. You do that, it's death. Penalty was death. So the whole idea was not that he was going to be whipped. You shouldn't think that Haridas Thakur was just being whipped. He was being whipped until he died. The only reason he went to 22 marketplaces is because he wouldn't die. But he's going to be whipped until death in public. Okay? So we have a situation here where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was born in the first place to come under the influence of Sharia law. Now that makes for a very exciting mixture, doesn't it? Because our God, the avatar that we're talking about here, he knew how to cope with the system. He knew how to cope. He got up and he went straight down the road with 100,000 people. If you have 100,000 people at your disposal, it certainly helps the conversation with your local imam. And he went to the local imam and he said, okay, let's talk about this. And as he was saying, let's talk about this, he was saying, no. Put his bushes back. Don't damage anything. Because Chaitanya Bhagavat says they'd started to damage. They wanted to rip the Chankazi's house apart. He said, no. We'll do this in a civilized way. Okay, let's talk. Let's talk religion. This is a civilized thing to do. It's called interfaith. Let's just talk. No pepper spray. Okay. No tasers. Let's just talk. Let's have a chat about religion. You want to say Allahu Akbar and we want to say Krishna Kija. Let's have a discussion. That discussion, my dear friends, is a very important discussion to have. And it will happen all over the world. We in our place have a contribution to make. But it will be done by talking. It will be done by talking. So, unfortunately, the problems still go on. In Advaitacharya's house in Shantipur, there is one priest who just a few weeks ago was killed. And he was knifed to death by three locals who just happened to be of a particular religious persuasion. So this is, this is a very real situation. So, in Shantipur, so I thought, okay, the last time I was in Shantipur, I thought, okay, let's go and see. I haven't been there for a long time. So in Shantipur, there are three Shalagram Shilas. Shalagram is a black rock. Could be that size, could be very small. And they are from a very holy place in the up in the Gandaki River, not too far from a place called Tibet. And you can go in this river, you will find them. If you're intended to find them, they will come to you. The more saintly you are, the more they will be attracted to you. Now, at least two of those Shalagrams in Shantipur that Advaitacharya was worshipping, they say, from 500 years ago. Because you go to many temples in India, and the deity is still there. The idea, although we haven't quite got hold of this idea in ISKCON yet, but is when you install deities, you install them for the minimum of 1,000 years. That's it. In other words, you put the jewels under the base, they're cemented in, they do not move. This is called the Mula Vigraha. And the Utsav Vigraha is a smaller version that does move. You take them on festivals or swing festivals like that. But the big, we call the big deities. Okay, how scientific we are. The big deities, the small deities. The Mula Vigraha and the Utsav Vigraha, they have different purposes. Anyway, so at least two of these are Narasimha. So the local expression is that when Advaita Acharya was worshipping the Lord, he was worshipping Narasimha. I don't know. I wasn't there. These are said to be those of Advaita. So the Lord gave knowledge of something known as Pancharatra. It came known as Pancharatra because it took place over 5 nights, and the Lord gave explanations of these, how to worship him over 5 nights to people like Narada Muni. And from Narada Muni, we get the Narada Pancharatra. So then the Lord spoke to Lord Shiva, and from Lord Shiva we get another book, another Pancharatra from Lord Shiva. What's it called? I forget. And from Lakshmi, we get the Lakshmi Tantra. So these are ways in which to serve the Lord. And they give the rituals, the ceremonies, and the festivals. So rituals are dependent on your consciousness, because your consciousness causes you to extrapolate your consciousness into a form of activity. That's bhakti. You take the inner consciousness and you extrapolate it into the outside world. When you do it with other people, it's called a ceremony. And when you do it with people who are, you know, just anybody, believers or non-believers, then we call that a utsav or a festival. Therefore, an utsav, everybody comes. Like when we have a Janmashtami, everybody comes. When we have a ceremony, it's normally a sort of closed group. And when you do a ritual, it's just for you. So we have different rituals, different ceremonies, different festivals. Some take place here, for instance, at Bhaktivedanta Manor. One lady, one professor once came. She said, Kripa Moya, can you help me? I said, yes, of course. She said, well, they tell me that you know about rituals. I said, well, I know something. Whatever I know, I'll help you. She said, well, when I ask the devotees, what rituals do you do in the morning program? They say, oh, no, we don't do rituals. We just do devotional service. She said, but, you know, the curtains open and everybody looks at the altar. Then everybody moves over to take Charanamrita. Then everybody moves back to Prabhupada and puts flowers and bows down. Then they sing. Then halfway through the song, the beat changes. Chakudana Dilo Jain. Everybody starts jumping. She said, that is ritualized behavior. And it is, actually. I mean, there's no reason. No one ever told you, okay, no one ever told you that halfway through the Guru Puja song that you had to start going faster. But we do. It's ritualized behavior. And the children learn it from the parents, don't they? Okay? Until we come to a deafening crescendo. Jaya, jaya, Prabhupada. And it's bang on the dot at 7:30 or whatever. So, why do we do that? It's musical ritual or ritual music. And everybody knows it, but we don't think about it. It's like the goldfish in the water who was asked, how's the water? And he says, what water? I can't see any water. When ritual is all around you, you don't notice it. So here's Advaita Acharya, and he's doing a ritual. There's just him. It's not a ceremony. He didn't invite anybody else along. But it's his. And he's following Pancharatra. Now, Pancharatra is mentioned in the Mahabharata by Bhishma as an ancient system, the ancient system of Pancharatra. What is Pancharatra? Well, we don't use the term very often, but you should know that we do it. When you get initiated and you have a fire yagya, that's Pancharatra. When you do Pushpanjali on an appearance day, that's Pancharatra. When you have sticks of incense and you wave them clockwise circles, that's Pancharatra. We're just following prescribed codes of behavior. When you ring a bell, and the first time you try and do rituals, you know, you're ringing a bell and you're trying to do the incense like this, okay, and it ends up you're either doing that or you're doing, you got the bell and you're doing the incense. And it takes some time to learn. And then someone tells you, oh, well, actually, there's a number of circles that you're supposed to do. Oh, no. And then circles, then you're counting circles for the first 5 years of your puja. So in Pancharatra, it said that there's five places where the Lord resides. That is in Vaikuntha, within the Vyuha expansions of Vasudeva, Sankarshan, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha, within his avatars, within his appearances, within the Paramatma, and within the deity. These five places you will find fully manifested the Lord. It's like being a thirsty man or a thirsty woman. You're very thirsty. The only thing you want is some water. Okay? And the Lord in Vaikuntha is said to be like a beautiful ocean of water, but a very long, long way away. It's very good that you'll be able to slake your thirst, but it's too far away for you to travel. And then the Lord, in his avatar form, as like a flash flood, the Lord comes, stays for some time, and then disappears. That's very nice, but that happened a few years ago, and I can't access that. Then the Lord in his form as Paramatma, as like a deep well, because you have to go into meditation and bore down very, very deep in order to access the Lord. I can't do that. Well, what can you do? Well, the deity of the Lord is a full manifestation, exactly the same as in Vaikuntha, exactly the same as in Paramatma form, exactly the same as his avatar form, but he agrees to be with you. And that is like a well in your village. And you can go and you can drink to your heart's satisfaction. So there are different forms of the Lord. You may serve the Lord in the form of a yantra, which is a geometric design that you draw. You can draw a geometric design on the beach. Okay? Usually you draw, you know, square and a circle and one of those triangular designs and place your finger in the middle and just chant the mantra. And you meditate that the Lord is appearing in this form. So if you do it with colors, it becomes a yantra, becomes a mandala. We like the word mandala, don't we? Buddhists use mandalas. The Jains use mandalas. It's a way to focus the mind and to serve the Lord. Usually it's a temporary form of the Lord. And sometimes the deity is movable or immovable. There's a beautiful deity of Lord Nrisimhadev who appeared to someone in a dream, and when he woke up from the dream, his name was Adivan Shatakopan. And when he woke up from the dream, he just found the Lord on his chest. And the Lord in the dream said, look, it's Kali Yuga. It's Kali Yuga. You have to take me traveling. Every 3 days, take me to a different village. And for the past 400 years, this deity has been in a different village every couple of days. And the deity has his shoes on. He came complete with shoes. So for traveling. He's like that. So everywhere you go, he's a beautiful deity. So the king was worshipping the deity, and then the king had a little bit of affection for Lord Shiva. So he asked, he said, please pour this pure gold into this mold of Lord Shiva. Every time he poured it into the gold, into the mold of Lord Shiva, it came out as Lord Nrisimhadev. He said, well, look, do it again. Do it again. Do it again. And on the fourth time, he said, all right. He said, the Lord wants to appear in this form. So that form you can still go to see. So they travel together. Can travel together. Anyway, thought you might like that. So serving the Lord is an extrapolation of how you want to approach the Lord. So you have to have something that you want to accomplish. And that's given either to you as a revelation, or it's given as a revelation to your guru, and your guru then gives you the murti, the deity, and he gives you the procedure to worship the deity. So from Prabhupada, in every one of Prabhupada's temples, we have Radha Krishna, Gauranitai, Jagannath, like that. And we have a procedure how to worship them. So this is what we do. We carry on this procedure. And the sadhana means that through this worship, I'm trying to achieve Krishna prema. So the Shalagram is particularly for sadhus who are traveling. And a shalagram is worshipped as either, you know, you could say Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan according to your conception. But all of Shastra says, you know, worship one of these and all your desires will be fulfilled. So the puja is very simple, just some Ganges water and some tulsi leaves and maybe a little sandalwood pulp, if you can manage that, and prayer. One time Prabhupada said, yes, he said, this is shalagram puja, and he said, mantras and then sleeping, mantras and sleeping. But shalagram is always traveling, because the sadhu, he always has the shalagram in his bag around his neck, like that. Therefore, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura says, when you see another Vaishnav, the first question to a Vaishnav is, my dear Prabhu, who do you have in that bag around your neck? Please tell me your service to him. And this is how Vaishnavs can begin a discussion. Who do you serve? I see you have a bag around your neck. Who do you serve? Vishwanath says. So, Alexander the Great, he tried to conquer India. And he tried. He couldn't do it. They were too powerful. He said, I've never known this. He said, I'm Alexander the Great. I'm great for a reason. I've conquered all throughout, you know, the Mediterranean, all throughout Asia Minor. I've come to India, and I can't crack it. And now some of my men have been killed, and some of them are trying to rebel. He said, go and ask somebody wise, what is the source of their power? And so some of the Brahmins came, and they said, this, Alexander, they said, very nice to meet you. He said, the source of India's power is four things. Four things. Shalagram, Tulsipatra, Gangajal, Bhagavad Gita. He said, with these four things, you will never conquer us. So Alexander the Great, he died before he conquered India. But these four things make India great. Huh? It's all over India. You go, some people will have heard of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, some not. Some will be worshippers of Ram, some will be worshippers of Krishna, but everybody will have heard of Bhagavad Gita, Tulsi, Gangajal, and Shalagram. Okay. So we want to worship in full knowledge. That's why the puja is defined in Shastra. Otherwise, if you don't follow Shastra, you end up worshipping a black doorknob, which is what one very, very faithful Indian lady did for 30 years. It was a black doorknob made of black, shiny, you know, Bakelite, and it was screwed on. So she said, yes, I have this shalagram for a long time. Look, you can see his chakra inside. It was the screw, absolutely symmetrical. And so the devotee said, oh, wonderful, your puja is wonderful. So now there are fake shalagrams on the market. Now they are making them from all kinds of different things and painting them. And if your consciousness is not pure, you will end up worshipping shalagram and using it as a nutcracker. You know that story? You know that story? Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati told the story of a man who engaged his professional Brahmin to come and worship his shalagram. So the idea is you have some sentiment, I should worship shalagram. But I'm a rich man. I can't, you know, I'm so busy making money, I can't afford the time. So let me pay one Brahmin to come. He'll come every morning and he knows all the mantras and tantras. He'll do it. I'll pay him. Okay? Easy formula. Again, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, you can't pay someone to do this puja for you. It doesn't work like that. He said, similarly, a guru should not think that his disciples are going to do devotional service for him. Oh, my disciples are out distributing books. I'm pleasing Prabhupada so much. No. No. If you want to please Prabhupada so much, you distribute books. The disciples' devotional service is their devotional service to Krishna. You ever heard this? The guru can't say, no, you distribute the books, and that's like me distribute. No, it's not. So he was paying his Brahmin to come. So the Brahmin was coming, and the rich man was, you know, every day he was coming, and it was all flowers and the incense, and he thought, well, very nice, I'm very happy. So then the next day he came. He said, let me spy on him. So he had given him some almonds, and almonds have a very tough shell. We usually buy almonds that are already shelled by a machine, but almonds you have to shell. They're very, very strong. Cashews, they come in a really strong case, don't they? Krishna makes them like that. So this man, he had taken the largest shalagram off the altar, and he was smashing the nuts, putting the shalagram back, and then offering the nuts to... So Bhakti Sananda told this story, and of course everybody was shocked to hear this. So one time he had this traveling exhibition going around, and he had different exhibitions, and he said, make one exhibition of the shalagram that was used as a nutcracker. And so they made a waxwork of a real life-size Brahmin using the cracked nuts, but they'd put Tripundra, Shivite Tilak on him. So all the local Brahmins, they became incensed. You are deliberately speaking about our community. This is a sectarian challenge on all the Shivite Brahmins of Navadvip and local areas and all the Durga worshippers. And they took him to court. They took the Gaudiya Mutt to court. And the sannyasis had to go to court to defend the Gaudiya mission. So Bhakti Siddhanta said, what is the problem? Guru Maharaj, they feel insulted. He said, oh, that's all right. He said, just paint Vaishnav Tilak on the Brahmin. Guru Maharaj, no Vaishnav would ever use a shalagram to crack nuts. He said, oh, yes, he would. Oh, yes, they would. He said, whatever is capable for another Brahmin is capable of for a Vaishnava Brahmin. He said, even their consciousness can fall that low. So it is the consciousness, not the ritual. The consciousness is the father and mother of the ritual. It's an extrapolation of what's going on in your mind. Everything we do is ritual. When someone lights a cigarette, it's ritual. When they order a martini or a particular cocktail with a little umbrella, sticking it in a little cherry and an olive, and I don't, by the way, but, you know, it's a ritual, okay? I was in a bar one day, selling something, and two young spivs, we would call them, came in with their girlfriends, and he ordered a flambeau, and it was a cocktail, and it was blue, and then as a final gesture, there was a cherry and an umbrella, and then the bartender, he poured a little extra alcohol on the top, and with a flourish. And something in Spanish, he just went, and the whole thing was lit up, okay? And he presented it. And the young chap looked at his girlfriend and he said, yeah, oh yeah. See, I knew what it was. You didn't know about this, but I know. He's fully relishing that he knew about this, but she didn't. And then he drank it. And I said, just out of interest, how much did that, you know, that whole sort of ritual cost you? He said, cost me £18. I said, it's a very quick drink, isn't it? He said, whatever. The point was, everything is a ritual. Everything is a ritual. So we're always speaking something and doing something. The whole point is, if you're speaking something can be Krishna, 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 and you're doing something can be Krishna, 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 then the rituals that you like to have in your life, you know, just the other day, in Rio, the opening of the Olympic Games. It's all ritual. It's all ritualized. Holding on to the flag and saying the Olympic, doing this, doing that. It's all ritual. But we do it to inculcate a sense of occasion. Okay, so we choose another deity. We choose another set of values. Good values, by the way, that people should have a sporting contest. These sporting contests were not unknown in our scriptures. And stadiums were not invented for football. Stadiums were invented for archery. You know, when Arjuna won the hand of Draupadi, it was a full stadium. Full stadium. And there was similarly rituals and all kinds of things going on. So it's not a new thing. But Brahmins must be there in order to elevate. So we have Brahmins. It's not that Brahmins are some Indian thing. Brahmin means a person whose consciousness is in Sattva Guna. And the higher the Brahmin, the more his consciousness will be in Vishuddha Sattva, more fixed on Brahman. But let me tell you, I just want to spend a couple of minutes here, why The consciousness of Advaita Acharya was so focused on bringing Krishna himself personally. Because as the young Swami said yesterday, he was saying that things cannot get any worse. Only God can save us. Only God can save us. It was a terrible situation. Terrible situation. On Charing Cross Road, every Saturday night, when we went on Harinam many years ago, Kishore, you'll remember this, someone would throw a liquid out of that window. You remember? It was just past St. Martin's College, or the College of Art, and we'd get to a particular window, and as the Harinam, and it became a game eventually, didn't it? We would taunt the person by doing Harinam under their window for a little while. The window would be flung open, and out would come a liquid. And the game was when the window was going to open and who would get the liquid. So we never found out what that liquid was, did we? It was either water or beer or something more foul. But every night when the devotees would gather for kirtan at Srivasangan, not only urine would come over the wall, but stool also. So we don't have that problem. We have had incidents of devotees going on Harinam and being stabbed. I remember one devotee was stabbed right here in Sarajevo. It was an English devotee, went on Harinam. And they came back beaten up and stabbed. They had a warning. Don't go down there. There's some, you know, rough people. They said, "Ah, Krishna, 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 Krishna." Well, you see, there's a very fine balance, my dear friends, between taking Krishna's protection and going on Sankirtan and being foolhardy. Okay? You have to. There are some parts of the city where Harinam may not be a good idea now. I'm thinking of certain parts of East London. Where you may, on a Friday, you may not want to tempt the locals by going there on Harinam. If you do, you're a braver man than me. But the point here is that it was very bad. It was a very bad situation. There was tantrics, and there was the local mullahs, and there was Sharia law, and there was all kinds of people set against the Vaishnavas. And Advaita just said, "What are we going to do? It's only Krishna can help us now." Things were that desperate. So in that mood, knowing full well the symptoms of the age of Kali, which are given in the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, just listen to the... just. Try and understand that we are firmly situated in Kali Yuga. And I suppose I'm approaching 60 now, so I think that things have never been this bad. But I think that any person of my age always says the same. They always say, back in 1940, it was, you know, the world was a wonderful place to live in. Now all you young people wearing your mini skirts and your, you know, your bell bottoms, taking these drugs, that things have never been so bad. So every generation, the old people talk about how things have become degraded. At the same time, the tendency of Kali Yuga is that you don't notice how things are becoming degraded and how fast, because it happens degree by degree. It's called the syndrome of the boiling frog. You know the boiling frog? He hops and, you know, he doesn't realize that the temperature's building up in the water because the lady's got the pot on the fire, and he boils to death because frogs can only detect big changes of temperature, not degree by degree. So degree by degree, as Kali Yuga comes into our society, even the Vaishnavas don't realize it. And Kali Yuga takes over our Vaishnav homes and our Vaishnav marriages and our Vaishnav child rearing and our Vaishnav organization and systems and structures and our Vaishnav sannyasis. You know, Kali Yuga is always knocking on the door waiting to come in. So we have to know the symptoms of Kali Yuga, you know, so that we can say, "I hear you knocking, but you can't come in. This is Kali Yuga, you keep at the door. I don't want you." Okay? Otherwise, you'll say, "Come on in, you know, I'm sure you're a devotee, come on in." Well, when Parikshit met Kali, he was killing a cow. So God forbid we should ever have a devotee that should kill a cow. But it did happen. It did happen. I had a god brother who played music, And he went and played music in a band, and he got introduced to a particular Middle Eastern religion. And by the end, he was working in a slaughterhouse. So it does happen. So degree by degree by degree. So the Acharyas say that a Vaishnava, to fall away from being a Vaishnava, it happens as the moon loses its brilliance, night by night by night by night by night. Okay? So it can happen. But only if you know that it can happen do you make preventative measures to guard against it. And you're very vigilant. Very vigilant. There's never a position where you can be free from vigilance. Okay? So these are the symptoms of the age of Kali. These eight things will decrease day by day by day. Religion means pure religion, genuine religion. Truthfulness, cleanliness. Okay, we know those, don't we? Because they're the foundation of our so-called four regulative principles. There are actually 64 regulative principles, but the four are the ones that we focus on because those are the four that you want to do, but you're not supposed to do. Okay, those are the ones that everybody struggles with. Those are the ones that people are horrified when they find out, you guys, I thought you guys were, you know, love and peace and flowers and, you know, but now I find out that you've got some pretty heavy religious rules. So cleanliness, austerity, truthfulness, and mercy, these things. But let's hear another thing that diminishes in Kali Yuga. It's forgiveness. It's forgiveness. When Vaishnavas can't forgive each other, the age of Kali has entered in. Duration of life. Duration of life. Bodily strength, you know, the food they give us to eat, the food they give us to eat, you know. I've just been to Spain to do a seminar for the Spanish devotees, and they have a farm, and every day they have fresh vegetables. And you can't believe the difference between eating fresh vegetables and eating frozen vegetables. But now frozen vegetables are the norm. And fresh vegetables are sort of, what do you want, some kind of health trip? You know? No one has fresh vegetables. Well, they always used to. Pre-1885, when everybody started moving into the cities, everybody grew vegetables. They had fresh vegetables. Bodily strength diminishes and memory. Memory decreases. Now we're in the grip of a worldwide disease that is rampant. It's worse than AIDS. It's called dementia. Dementia just means that you actually forget. You forget. It's just the part of brain associated with. And whether it comes from aluminium or whether it comes from something else, they're trying to trace it down. The whole of the scientific community is going crazy trying to find a cure for dementia because people are falling victim to dementia earlier and earlier and earlier. It's taking away the duration of life and their memory. So the mighty force of time takes these away. Prabhupada says these eight things will gradually decrease to nil or almost nil. These are eternal principles, eternal values of cleanliness, truthfulness, austerity, mercy, forgiveness. When you have these, you have a society guided by Brahminical principles. But we still have executive heads. Every time you open up the Bhagavatam and you read about a king, he's always wandering through a forest, isn't he? And he's saying, oh, my dear maiden of slim waist and lotus eyes, who are you? I mean, and we think, as people who try to live a Brahmin life, that's no way to talk to a woman. That's a chat-up line, if ever I heard one. Okay? That's a king. He's not called a Raja for nothing. The king is enjoyment and protection. Vigilance, guardian of society. The problem we have now is that democratic society elects accountants to the positions of kings. We have most people who, when they're elected into a political position, immediately they start talking about the economy, it's the economy, the markets, the economy, the markets, the economy. We did not ask you to take the supreme executive position in order that you would become a shopkeeper. We're not interested in that. We're interested in our culture, our society, our children being guarded from these influences. So do it. Okay, do it. But what is it going to take to stop crime? What is it going to take? It's going to take great amount of vigilance, but the more police you put out, there's a secret, and the secret is provided by brahminical people. There's no amount of pepper spray to control society, make people be good people. There's no amount of tasers that you can ever distribute. Just like the other day, 600 new armed police will be there in London to protect us against terrorists. What happened? What happened? On the very night, or the very next night, someone was killed in Russell Square, okay, and five other people were injured. You know, where were your 600 armed police then? Well, where can 600 people go in London? Where can they go? It's already happened. All that happens is that you'll get there after the event. Well, what we're looking for is how to change people in the moment of choice between being a bad person or an unhealthy person or a mentally ill person. We can stop mental illness. We can stop mental illness by banning certain drugs. But we're not in a position to do so. We can stop crime by having a fair distribution of wealth. There are many ways in which Vedic culture, or our Krishna consciousness culture, has specific ideas. Yes, we can tell people to chant Hare Krishna. That they do. But for reformation of society, so that society itself won't collapse, we have a lot to do. We have a lot of ideas to be taken from Shastra and applied just for leadership. Just for leadership. There's a lot we have to say. So this movement is meant to do two things. It's meant to be followers of Advaita Acharya. You know, officially, there is an Advaita Acharya Sampradaya. Did you know this? There's an Advaita Acharya Sampradaya. Descendants of the descendants of the descendants of Advaita Acharya. Now they number 30 million people. But nobody's heard of them. Nobody's heard of them. It's not a movement. This is people who got some form of initiation when they were very young. The whole point of initiation is it's planting a seed, and a seed is meant to do stuff. It's meant to grow into a tree, and the tree is meant to produce fruits. So initiation into the line of Advaita Acharya is actually meant to produce the same consciousness as Advaita Acharya, that people are suffering. And now we have to call the Lord in the form of his most merciful manifestation into society to help. But you have to feel people's pain before you become a preacher, doesn't it? You actually have to be convinced that people are suffering, that the world really needs this message, because otherwise two things will happen. I'm becoming Krishna conscious and damn everybody else. That's one attitude. Or I'm becoming Krishna conscious and the world is not as bad as the Shastra makes it out to be. Actually, everybody else is enjoying except me. Since I've been following these four regulated principles, I've had a very miserable life and everybody else is enjoying. So woe is me, I'm just going to chant and I can't preach in this consciousness. So that these two things can stop us from becoming a preacher. The whole point is, and when you multiply that many thousands of times, you find that we have a movement of people who are thinking like that, and people are not preaching. Yeah, some people are preaching, okay? Maybe 10% are preaching. But now 90% of our ISKCON movement, of the followers of Advaita Acharya, they have never lived in a temple, never will live in a temple, and they're making choices. They're making choices every day based on whether to give Krishna consciousness to others in a particular form. If you want to do it, you can do it. Everybody can do it. All you have to say to Krishna is, my dear Lord, I'm so weak that I'm never going to make this effort on my own. Can you please make my sharing of Krishna consciousness, your message, with another human being a little bit easier for me? As soon as you say that, Krishna sends you someone. But you better be looking. Okay? Otherwise, it's like a person who calls the taxi and the taxi turns up and the man says, "Did you call a taxi?" And you say, "Yeah, it's all right. You can go. I'm waiting for a taxi to come." "Yeah, no, I'm the taxi." No. I'm waiting for a taxi to come." "No, I am the taxi. No, I'm waiting for one to come." You see, you call out to Krishna and you ask Krishna, "Please send me someone that I can give this message to." Krishna sends someone, but it doesn't quite, or she doesn't quite look like the person you were expecting. Okay? The point is, that is the person. That is the person. And based on that interaction, Krishna will send you another person. Why do some book distributors always get the people that go away with a stack of books? Is it because they're better? Or is it because they want to meet someone like that? Is there a certain magnetism that a good book distributor gets that, practically speaking, just zip, 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 attracts people to him or her? Huh? I'd like to think it was the latter. I'd like to think that Vishwambhas, Sutapa, you book distributors have a certain magnetism. You know, people see you and they go, "Oh, looks interesting. Let me see what he's got." Because otherwise, another person can go out and come back at the end of the day and, "Oh, it was really tough. Really, really, really tough." And another person comes back and says, "Wow, what a fantastic day I've had." You see? It's called Paramatma connection. You can be in touch. So people will be drawn towards this movement if you yourself are asking them to come. Prabhupada was so sure that his movement would grow, that even when he had nothing and no one, the man said, you know, Mr. Rubin said, "What have you got?" He said, "Oh, I've got temples all over the world. I've got farms. I've got schools, thousands of followers. But the time is separating us. Time is separating us." And you should also think like that. How are you going to make a contribution? How are you going to make your contribution? You should just think, well, this is what I want. And if I pray to Krishna, this is what, if he's pleased with me, he may give me. But the time is separating. Time is separating. But we can't wait until we are 70. Okay? It's not our philosophy that everybody should wait until they're 70. Because if Kali Yuga progresses, and you may forget everything that you learn by the time you get to 70. Prabhupada didn't. He learned verses. You know the 700 verses in the Bhagavad Gita? And in his classes, without reference to any written material, Prabhupada uses 600 and something verses. Do you know, Deepak? I mean, you go through. Now we have computers that will scan all of Prabhupada's classes and tell us which verses he used most. So there's like a Premier League of verses. There's a first division, second division, third division, and a junior league, Coca-Cola league. So Prabhupada uses certain verses, but the sum total of the verses that Prabhupada uses is way over 600. So this is the amazing thing, that without reference, and he didn't forget one of them. Didn't forget one of them. So I learned some verses when I was younger. I can't remember what they are. So don't wait till you're 70. You may forget everything that you learn. Best is when you're young. That's why Prabhupada's movement was made up of young people. He didn't go for middle-aged people, did he? He went for the youngsters because they were just fresh and they came to it fresh. Look, I just want to say something because otherwise I shall be... these are the other symptoms of the age of Kali. I will be 9:05. Is that okay? Is that okay? Okay. A man's qualities and his social position will be according to the extent of his wealth. Someone said to me the other day, I saw what they call it, a meme going around, you know, on the present presidential elections in America. You know, more than 300 million people, and you had to pick these two to choose from. And a devotee commented to me, actually, he said, the Americans don't like the idea of monarchy. They don't like the idea of monarchy. But you could point to three families that have dominated politics in the last, 20 years, practically speaking. Before it was the Kennedys, now it's the Clintons, and who else? The Bushes, Because in order to become a president of the United States, you have to have at least, what's the first round? The primaries will cost you more than $100 million, isn't it? You have to have $100 million just to start. So according to the Bhagavatam description, these men, or now women, are kings. They're kings. When you have so much wealth and so much power, the Bhagavatam describes you as a king. So really, you have to be a monarch even to remotely think about running for becoming a candidate. And according to a person's wealth, we then judge how they will be in a position. Oh, he would make a very good president because he's a billionaire. No. The president also has to be the commander-in-chief with his finger on the nuclear button. Don't put a shopkeeper in charge of the army. Okay? You have the situation in... Anyway, it's going into world politics. Religious principles and justice will be determined by a show of strength. It's the other week in Turkey. We had that situation. Who has the most power is the person who's in the right. Marriages will be arranged according to temporary affection. Because now even the principle of marriage has practically disappeared. People now do not talk of marriage, they talk of moving in together, isn't it? And even in our Krishna consciousness movement, devotees who should know better are not getting married, using Prabhupada's words as an excuse. Kali Yuga has entered in into our marriages and divorces. People don't even think of getting married. They move in together. You see, even the gurus are not telling their disciples to get married. It's a shocking state, but Kali Yuga has moved in. I'm old enough to say these things and not be controversial. They won't boot me out. Well, they've already done that. But a successful businessman is one who cheats. If a man has no money, he cannot get justice. Agree? These are all there in the Bhagavatam. If a man does not have money, he can't get justice. Okay? Anyone who can juggle words is a scholar. Yeah. Oh, what did Prabhupada say? Prabhupada was expert. He not only could imitate the sound of different animals and birds and also vehicles. Prabhupada could do vehicles. Prabhupada once made the sound of a dustbin truck, taking on rubbish. He was in America. He made the sound with his mouth. Everybody was like, "How did you do that?" I didn't know Prabhupada was an impressionist. so then he said he was imitating a scholar. And a scholar, he said, invents words that you don't know the meaning of in order to, that he will look. So he just off the cuff, he just said, it is a dalbendi, lactalized by a plactony of tinder. I said, what does that mean? He said, in this way they speak. He just made up four words on the spot. A dalbendi lactalized by a plactony of tinder. So I just wanted to say something about the Ganga. Just because Vishwambhar is in the room. Because Vishwambhar in the room, every time I see Vishwambhar, I think of a great king. Not only because he's very kingly, but I remember him in a play of Harish Chandra. And Harish Chandra had a son called Rohit. Rohit, okay. So in the later cantos of the Bhagavatam, we find the genealogy of the family tree coming from the Surya, some Suryavams. So Suryavams begins with Surya himself, or the demigod of Surya, and this is Vaivaswatamanu. Vaivaswatamanu. Also in that family came the great king of Ambarish. Do you realize, if I say these names, I make spiritual progress. If you utter these names in this great dynasty of Suryavamsa, we make progress. So let's say it. Vaivaswatamanu, Ambarish, Harish Chandra, Sagar. Very good. And then Sagar's grandson, Amshuman. Okay, now he searched for the sacrificial horse that had been stolen by Indra. What is it about Indra that he's always stealing horses? He did the same with Prithu Maharaj. He's always stealing the 100th sacrificial horse. He has to stop someone. He's like a politician, Indra. Hare Krishna. He has to stop someone from reaching the peak. This is modern life. If I see someone who's becoming successful, Prabhupada said, oh, he's become a judge. No, I don't think they're paying him. You see, he may become a judge, but he's not getting the correct salary. In other words, I have to justify my envy of a person by bringing him down. So he looked for a sacrificial horse, and he sees Kapila, and he sees the ashes of his uncle in the ashram of Kapila. So then his grandson, Amshuman's grandson, whose name was Bhagiratha. Bhagiratha! He prays that Ganga Devi will come down to earth. Prays that the Ganges will come down to earth. And of course, only when Lord Shiva, Mahadev, he agrees that he will take the force of Ganga Devi on his head, and then from his hair, you know, she comes and she flows down through Bharata. So from this great Bhagiratha, we have the great Ganges. And in this line also, we have Dasharatha. And from Dasharatha, we have the king, Rama. So all this is Suryavams. So all these different names, they did something. And Chayavan Muni, he was also in that line because one of the daughters was married to him. So in the family, usually in a family tree, when you look at the family tree, there's no one that's, you know, some family trees are, you know, he was a nice man, this one was a bit dodgy, and this one, well, we don't talk about him. But in the Suryavamsa, we find all these different persons who are worthy of our attention. And, of course, in the dynasty of the moon, the Chandravamsa, we find Lord Krishna himself. That's another story. So the two stories come together, actually, in Bhishma. The two dynasties come together in Bhishma. Why? Why do the two dynasties come together in Bhishma? The two separate family trees, why do they come together in Bhishma? Because Ganga Devi was the mother of Bhishma, that's right. Ganga Devi was the mother of Bhishma. And she came to him just as he was leaving this world. Wasn't it? The arrow shot by Arjuna came and gave him Ganga Jal. She was merciful to him. So Ganges is a river that's a very long way away. No. That is why in Pancharatra we have the Ankush Mudra. You can hold your right hand up in the air like this. It's for calling Ganga. You take two fingers, you fold them down. Last two fingers, fold them down. You put your thumb over the top of those two fingers. Okay. One finger goes up like this, and the second finger is like that. Okay. And put them together. Okay. So they should look like that. Okay. Very good. Thank you. And then you touch water, and you ask for the Ganges to come. She will come. She's very merciful. So this Ankush Mudra we do. Om Gangaye Chamune Chaiva. We're going through the rivers. Godavari, Saraswati, Narmada, Sindhu, Kaveri, Jale, Smin, Sanidim, Kuru. There you are. All the rivers in your body have just now become the seven holy rivers. You should feel very powerful. All right. Thank you very much for allowing me, Nanda, to come again and ramble on. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki jai.